Blog Talk Radio.
Yeah, good evening. It's the LA School Show. And tonight we're going to, going to go to a book that I picked up a number of years ago. I think it was written in 2000, so it was about 8 years ago, 9 years ago that I got it. It was actually written in 1994. I believe I bought it in about 2000 when I first saw it. It's called Dialogues with a Modern Mystic by Andrew Harvey and Mark Matusik. And the amazing thing about the book is that it was really well done. Dog out of here. But go. You want to call the dog, Mom? Yeah. Go. Come on. It's very difficult. I have a dog, and of course, he wants to be a part of the show. Can't understand that. There he is again. The book is called Dialogues with a Modern Mystic, and it was written by Andrew Harvey and Mark Matusik. And the way that it works is it's a dialogue, and it's Mark Matusik asks questions, and Andrew Harvey answers them. And remarkable, some of the insights in this book. I've gained a great appreciation for some of Andrew Harvey's insights, and I'd like to share them with you tonight. And I don't know how far we can get on this, but I felt I might as well start with part one. And I tried to find this book. It's not listed. Andrew Harvey also has a website, and you just put in his name. It's It's Andrew Harvey, Sacred Insights or something like that, Institute for Sacred Activism. And just so you know, I'm just reading from his own website here. It says, Andrew Harvey is a renowned and distinguished mystical scholar, Rumi translator and explicator, poet, novelist, spiritual teacher and writer and architect of sacred activism. You can go into that on your own. Tonight I really didn't want to get into that aspect of it. There's videos. He's got quite a bit of a lot of information here to share. And I'm not sure if we're quite ready. Possibly after I do some reading with this, but this book is my introduction to his work or his reasoning. And the part one is The Concentration Camp of Reason. As Mark Matusik asks, you've begun by calling this the dark age in human history. To some, this may seem an exaggeration. And Andrew Harvey answers, our unwillingness to face the extremity of the situation is part of the problem. We are certainly at the end of a civilization, a whole cycle of history, and possibly at the end of the world. The facts of our global crisis, a crisis that is at once political and economic, philosophical, or psychological and environmental, show us clearly that the human race has no hope of survival unless it chooses to undergo a total change of heart, a massive, quiet, unprecedented spiritual transformation. Only the leap into a new consciousness can engender the vision, moral compassion, joy, and energy necessary to effect change on the scale and with the self-sacrifice necessary to save the planet in a time we have. The message we are being sent by history can be summed up in four words: transform or die out. Many experts agree that we have at the most 15 or 20 years left before extreme crisis becomes unalterable catastrophe. Teilhard de Chardin wrote, "Humanity is being taken to the point where it will have to choose between suicide or adoration. I have no doubt that we are at a point now, at that point now. Human survival depends on whether we are brave enough to face the full desolation of what we have done to our psyches and the planet, and wise and humble enough to turn to the divine inside and outside us to learn what we will need to go forward." The last time I saw the great Catholic mystic and visionary B.D. Griffiths, just before he died, he blessed me and said, "The hour of God and mankind's greatest ordeal is now here. Can we get through?" I asked him, "The mercy and the help of God is always stretched out to us, always," he said, "even now at this late hour. But we must be humble enough to ask for them. Everything depends on whether we can abandon our pride before it is too late." Mark Matusik, who is the questioner here, or co-author of this book, says, "I don't disagree with a word of what you're saying, but isn't it also true that apocalyptic scenarios have always been around?" I just let my dog out of the room. And he asks, "Isn't it true that apocalyptic scenarios have always been around?" This is not an apocalyptic scenario, says Andrew Harvey. Not a scenario at all. In fact, it is where we are. It is what is happening. It is terrifying, and anyone not in a trance of denial knows it. No amount of wishful thinking and sophisticated drawing of pseudo-historical parallels can make this agony go away. It is hard enough for a human being to face the fact of his or her own mortality. What we have to face now is not merely our own death, but the possible death of everything and everyone we love, the holocaust of nature herself, the mother we have ignored and betrayed for so long. If we do not face our present danger in all its horror without consolation or illusion, we will never find in ourselves the passion and courage necessary to change. Catastrophe can become grace and disaster possibility only if we use their own energy against them by accepting what they have to teach us and acting with complete sincerity to transform ourselves. Last year I was in Bodh Gaya, meditating near the place of the Buddha's enlightenment. These words of the fire sermon came to me. "Monks, all is burning. The eye is burning. Visible forms are burning. Burning with what? Burning with the fire of lust. Burning with the fire of hatred. Burning with the fire of delusion." As I heard these words inwardly, I saw in my mind's eye a forest in the Amazon erupt in flames. The vast flame burst from Hiroshima. The blaze of gas above, of the blaze of a gas oven in a concentration camp, gutted in burning huts in Somalia, Angola, Cambodia, and the charred and smoking hills around Sarajevo. And I saw and understood with an intensity and grief I had never before been strong enough to bear the full horror of what this century has accomplished. And that was the 20th century, I have to remind you, my readers, because this was in 1994. Now you wrote this book. "Your spiritual training did nothing to mitigate this pain," Mark Matusik asks. "On the contrary," Andrew says, "awakening brings with it a heightened sensitivity to pain. No true mystic is sentimental. I know very well the evil in myself, so I know that the inner world of humankind's psyche has always been on fire with lust, delusion, and hatred. These fierce powers have created terror and destruction throughout recorded history, in only a very few periods of relative calm. What makes our contemporary situation so particularly menacing is that these powers in us now have at their disposal a range of lethal technologies that can do anything. Now the external world is burning to death in the fires of our inner madness. Mark Matusik asks, in other words, evil is not increasing, only its tools. And Andrew Harvey states, this century has seen a quantum leap in the powers that our evil has at its command. A medieval Mongol or ancient Roman on a horse could, on a good day, kill 50 women and children and burn down a village or two. A ruthless modern dictator with which the modern world is swarming can wipe out a country before breakfast. Greedy and amoral people have always done harm, but now, with the power of the media being as universal as it is, a handful of unscrupulous and cynical moguls can trivialize and deaden the minds of billions and darken the course of a whole civilization. And the massacres of the past, though filled with every form of cruelty, did not menace all existence down to the last dolphin and mouse and fern. And Mark Matusik says, this destruction extends beyond the physical world into our hearts, minds, and souls. And Andrew Harvey says, yes, there has always been in the human psyche a tendency to rage against wisdom and its demands, but this tendency has escalated through technology and mind control to what can only be called the genocide of wisdom. The Chinese have decimated Tibet, the home of what may be the supreme wisdom culture humankind has seen. Industrial progress has fundamentally threatened indigenous people all over the world, from the Hopis to the Yanomamis, to the Inuits, from the Kogis to the Todas, to the Australian Aborigines, who have preserved against insuperable odds and over stretches of time the sacred ancestral knowledge of our species. We have silenced many of the gentle, patient voices that could have warned or guided us at the very moment when we needed their inspiration most. Mark Matusik asks, what more, we conspire subtly with this genocide, though fatalism in the face of so much bad news. And Andrew Harvey replies, a friend of mine was one of the survivors in a plane crash. He described the last few minutes before the plane hit the mountain. That during the first 5 minutes, as people realized the end was coming, they screamed, sobbed, and prayed out loud. In the next 2 minutes, this subsided, and finally at the end, people just sat there numb, frozen to their seats. I often think that many people feel themselves to be in those last few minutes, too stunned even to cry out. So much in our official culture conspires with this passivity, its relentless trivialization of serious issues, its passion of distraction, its fanatical, irrational belief in reason and the power of science to explain away everything, prevent us from facing where we are and what we do. The liberals announce calmly the death of Satan at the very moment when Satan in us is having an orgy of universal destruction. And the ozone layer is gaping over Alaska and South America and Australia, while the papers are full of photographs of Madonna's latest bullet bra. And thousands of irrecoverable and sacred species of animals, plants, and insects vanish each month. And all the media has been excited by the week in whether Hillary Clinton has insulted the dignitary of peas. A billion or more people live on less than a dollar a day in conditions of desperate misery. Well, Hollywood goes on churning out violent, mind-numbing garbage that celebrates precisely those values that threaten our existence. It is October 1993, and there are currently 26 wars raging in the world, yet networks go on hiring expert psychologists to prove that there is no connection between the violence and sexual obsessions on our screens and the epidemics of rape and child abuse sweeping our civilization. The rhetoric of democracy prevents us from acknowledging our imprisonment. We talk about a new world order while selling lethal arms to countries who threaten it. We will talk about freedom and live in a slavery to the consumerism and a worldwide celebration of just those qualities of egoism, aggression, greed, competitiveness that keep us in Milton's great description of Satan. Thyself not free, but to thyself enthralled. And so unfree in every sacred sense, we struggle to improve our well-being, and every available ruse and pill and gadget and only succeed in straying more and more desperately from that inner sanity and peace of soul that are the only abiding sources of either physical or mental health. Anyone who tries to tell us these truths is immediately marginalized and treated as crazy or irrational or morbidly apocalyptic. This guy was prophetic. This was written in 1994. Which was, what, 15 years ago? Yeah. 15 years ago. And James Baldwin, whom I revere as a writer and prophet, this is Andrew Harvey also stating, James Baldwin, who I revere as a writer and prophet of our culture, said to me once, "The bomb has already gone off." "What bomb?" I asked. "The psychic bomb, the master bomb. It goes off and nobody notices. It destroys hearts, souls, and minds while leaving the bodies and refrigerators intact." Mark Matusik says, or asks rather, "You're painting a terrible, desperate picture. What does all of this have to do with mysticism?" And Andrew Harvey says, "Everything." George Eliot said, "The highest election known to man is to live without opium." A person with serious cancer has no chance whatsoever of healing it if she goes on pretending she has pneumonia or a migraine. We do not have the time not to face what we are living in, a concentration camp of reason, where we are lied to about everything important, starting with our essential divine identity, and where we are policed by nihilism and depression, systematically reduced to addicts of sex, money, power, and status, whose incessant stimulation fuels the very system that imprisons and paralyzes us. As the great Tibetan master Sogyal Rinpoche has written so movingly, "Sometimes I think that the greatest achievement of modern culture is its brilliant selling of samsara, of ignorance and illusion, and its barren distractions. Modern society seems to me a celebration of all the things that lead away from the truth, make truth hard to live for, and discourage people from even believing that it exists." Man, is that real? That is so real, folks. And that's what we've been, I don't know, this is what we try to do, try to bring truth to people. It's very difficult. He continues this modern samsara feeds, he continues stating, "This modern samsara feeds off an anxiety and depression that it carefully nurtures with a consumer machine that needs to keep us greedy to keep going. This samsara is highly organized, versatile, and sophisticated. It assaults us from every angle and its propaganda and creates an almost impregnable environment of addiction around us. Obsessed with hopes, dreams, and ambitions which promise happiness but lead only to misery, We are like people crawling through an endless desert, dying of thirst, and all that this culture holds out to us is to drink is a cup of salt water designed to make us thirstier. This is the clearest and most ruthless description I can offer of the concentration camp in which we currently exist. And Mark Matusik asks, it's a camp without walls, a camp of the mind that encourages us to become our own torturers. And Andrew Harvey states, and encourages us to feel worthless. This is why more of us don't escape. How did 100 guards in Auschwitz keep thousands of prisoners docile except by making them feel disgusting, subhuman? By banning the awareness of our transcendent nature and of spiritual wisdom in general, our culture deprives us of our true selves. We are encouraged to view ourselves as dying, greedy animals. By killing God in the Nietzschean sense, we have come close to killing ourselves. And the my pronunciation here. Taittiriya Upanishad tells us, who denies God denies himself. By deriding mystic truth, we have nearly severed ourselves from any source of divine wisdom. We no longer know who we are and who we can be. And Mark Matusik asks, rather than helping, science has added a great deal to this confusion. And Andrew Harvey states, think of what the materialist scientists, high priests of this camp, who dominate biology and physics, are telling us about our real nature. Stephen Jay Gould describes evolution as a stately dance to nowhere. Dawkins, in The Selfish Gene, informs us that we are survival machines, robots blindly programmed to preserve the selfish molecules known as genes. Our internationally canonized Pope of Cosmic Knowledge, Stephen Hawking, pronounces, we are insignificant creatures on a minor planet of a very average star in the outer suburbs of one of 100 million galaxies. So it is difficult to believe in a God that would care about us or even notice our existence. As if the divine obeys any of our categories of space, time, or scale, and is not as miraculously present in a flower as Blake and Rumi and Lao Tzu have all in different ways and at different times told us. As in the whole universe, the prestigious so-called wisdom of our leading scientists is stunted, morbid depressiveness camouflaging itself as empirical truth and illusionless accuracy. Its false authority, completely divorced from the essential evidence of the enlightened mind, rots our resolve at the very moment when we need it most and deepens that sense of impotence and worthlessness with which we are already afflicted as refugees from 2,000 years of Christian propaganda about original sin. And when you add to this the smart relativism of the reigning contemporary philosophies and the celebration of works with titles as absurd as Consciousness Explained and the neurotic conviction of our limitations which permeates much of serious modern art, you come to see humanity dazed and baffled and hemmed in from all sides by images of ineptitude and meaninglessness at a moment when vision is as imperative as oxygen. The real war in the modern world is not between democracy and communism, or between capitalism and totalitarianism, or between liberalism and fascism. It is the war for the mind and the heart of the humankind between two completely different versions of reality, the version that materialistic science, most contemporary philosophy, and most modern art gives human beings as driven, dying animals in a random universe, a version that many institutionalized religions, especially Christianity and Islam, unconsciously abet with their emphasis on human sinfulness and smallness. And that version of humankind's essential divine destiny that mystics in all ages, all spiritual traditions, all historical circumstances have discovered and struggled to keep alive. This latter version can be summed up in the wonderful words of the great Sufi master Al-Ghazali. Then he states, "Know, O beloved, man has not created in jest or at random, but marvelously made for some great end." Or, in the glorious promise of St. Francis of Assisi, "It is in dying of self that we are born to eternal life." Or, in the call to transcendence of the central Hindu scripture, the Bhagavad Gita. I'm sorry about my pronunciation on these. But bear with me. "He is forever free who has broken out of the ego cage of I and mine to be united with the Lord of Love." This view can only be seen in an account by Buddhist master Kenpo of what enlightenment is like. An effortless compassion can arise for all beings who have not realized their true nature. So limitless is this that I fear that if tears could express it, you would cry without end. You are naturally liberated from all suffering and fear. Then if you were to speak of the joy and bliss that arise from this realization, it is said by the Buddhas that if you were to gather all the glory, enjoyment, pleasure, and happiness of the world and put it together, it would not approach one tiny fraction of the bliss that you experience upon realizing the nature of your mind, or rather the nature of mind. Mark Matusik states, "The truth is that without an incontestable experience of transcendence, a direct perception of the sacredness of life, no sane person would care if a species capable of such atrocities survived or not." And Andrew Harvey states, "No, and if we do not awaken to our sacred interdependent nature, we will not know that when we allowed the rainforest to burn, it is as if we were burning our own lungs. That when we pollute the seas and the nuclear waste, we are lacing our own veins with poison. And that when we refuse to stop the torture in prisons all over the world, or to intervene in Bosnia, or to feed the starving in Asia and Africa, we are torturing, killing, and starving ourselves. Not figuratively, not poetically, but literally." When Teilhard speaks of the choice between suicide and adoration, he is not referring to one gorgeous kind of emotionalism, but to the highest means of opening to the sacred truths of reality in order to arm ourselves with the love and clarity that will protect our world. Mark Matusik states that our prevailing image of God in the West as a judgmental entity separate from ourselves will have to be transcended from this wisdom you're discussing to take hold. And Andrew Harvey states, "A secular culture does not teach that God is power absolutely informed with love. Love is the transforming and creative power of the universe. Any power that is not love is not real power. The West has simply not been able to understand that it is divine wisdom and goodness that irradiate true intelligence, not the intellect. Our inability to understand that traps us is our present nihilism." And how else would the ego interpret God except as a greater monster than itself? It cannot see God completely as love, because if it did, it would fall in love with the love and want to enter it. The great love would burn the camp walls down with peace and destroy the prison. The ego cannot afford to understand the nature of God as love, because if it did, it would die of heartbreak and longing. The ego can only go on surviving when it sees God as its own projection. As Hitler writ large, the fantasy that the ego has created of existence, that there's only death here, necessitates a sadistic God who has created this terminal theater. And Mark Matusik asks, or states, God is our ideal torturer, then, the abusive father without a heart. And Andrew Harvey states, well, we've grown up in the shadow of a debased Christianity that gloats over our failings without teaching us that, what Matthew Fox calls original blessing. Christian church has, for many centuries, given up its vital responsibility to create living mystics of great attainment. It has concentrated on the external without doing the essential work of transformation. What I hope the Christian church will learn from the great explosion of mystical understanding that is sweeping the West is to take very seriously the Buddhist and Hindu technologies of sacredness and create its own circle of masters who have been Christed, who can lead not with words but from full realization. Just imagine if a great contemporary Catholic saint had the courage that Saint Francis had to get up and say, this church is rotten at its core, it is destroying the energy of Christ in the world and making it impossible for this glorious power to heal the world at the moment it needs it most. And those are the words of Saint Francis of Assisi. And I have a fantasy about Mother Teresa getting up at one of these endless Vatican councils and telling the church that it must give all of its money to the poor, embrace the sick and homosexuals and women, stop abetting monstrous regimes all over the world, and put into practice Christ's injunctions to end the reign of injustice on earth. Think what a revolution that might bring. It would be something, huh? Would have been something. Imagine, too, if the church could take seriously what the Virgin is saying in Megajugger. I should know better. Instead of when I jump into some of these readings, there are so many unfamiliar words to me. I have to chew through them. And it says, imagine, too, if the church would take seriously what the Virgin is saying in Medjugorje. What is a church without that what is a church worth that cannot stand behind divine revelation? Which cannot say yes to its direct media tricks at a crucial moment in world history, who is saying absolutely essential things before millions of believers every day. The creation is groaning for the Divine Mother today, but her message of universal tolerance and the abandonment of dogma is too threatening for the hierarchy to absorb. Christ is longing to come to the center of the world mind in an authentic way to play his part in the transformation, although the crucifixion and resurrection are, of course, inseparable. I think the emphasis on a risen, glorified Christ should prevail at this moment. This would give Christianity a version of Christ in his final mystical splendor and help Christians worship the potential of the enlightened, resurrected one in all of us. It would encourage Christians to view the whole universe as tending toward a transfiguration in the light, what Teilhard called the Omega Point. This would link Christianity directly with the ancient Eastern traditions of enlightenment and pave the way forward for all the mystical traditions to work in harmony together towards the same goal of a transformed humanity. And Mark Matusik asks, what use are the so-called New Age philosophies in this necessary transformation? answers. That is a complex question. The New Age is a grab bag of many different unrelated pieces of various traditions and fantasy, and while it has undoubtedly helped to begin a spiritual path, it has many of the marks of the diseases it is pretending to cure. It is hardly surprising that a materialistic culture without a wisdom trend tradition, and until recently almost completely ignorant of the laws of interchange, would spawn the kind of consumerist, naive, and narcissistic spirituality we see all around us. This would be less dangerous if the stakes were not so high. What lies before us is so demanding that only a sober, unsparing, mature vision of what transformation entails can be of use to us now. A vision that does not lie to us about the sacrifice or the difficulty of the darkness. So many of the visions on sale are palliatives, placebos, half-truths that misrepresent the rigorous nature of spiritual life and the necessity to work with an authentic master. As in the Christian church, there are very few realized mystics working as teachers in the New Age. Almost anyone can set up shop, and desperation will always provide customers. In an age that adores instant solutions, there is a hungry audience for versions of the journey that offer instant enlightenment for a few dollars. In an age that adores ease and castrates us with comfort, it is not surprising that pop philosophy should promise sudden divine shifts that will save us all, and floatings off to other planets and spaceships. These are some of the camp's most insidious lies, since they masquerade as escapes from it. There's a dangerous confusion, Matusik states, there is a dangerous confusion in the New Age between absolute and relative reality as defined by the perennial traditions. Ramana Maharshi says that Brahman is real, the universe is unreal, and that Brahman is the universe. And the third statement explains the first two. It signifies that when the universe is perceived apart from Brahman, that perception is false and illusionary. And unfortunately, people understand this subtle point to mean that matter doesn't matter, that only the transcendent of it, only the transcendent is of value. This confusion drains us of responsibility and outrage. And Andrew Harvey states, the divine exists. Humankind is being helped. There are realized masters on earth. However, it is essential that we not be distracted from the real task ahead by a misunderstanding of the laws of absolute reality or spiritual diversion. The light can save us, but we must work with it. And Mark Matusik asks, or states, we need, in point of fact, a clear science of enlightenment, stripped of New Age vagueness and naivete. And Andrew Harvey says, yes, desperately. If we had only the external sciences to rely on, the game would already be lost. Fortunately, there exists another empiricism altogether. Interrelated technologies of spiritual transformation developed by all the major mystical traditions and still miraculously intact and available to us. It is time that Westerners realize that mystics are scientists in their domain, that mystical union and transformation obeys laws as inexorable as those of the physical universe. These laws are documented by systems of the most sublime sophistication, which can help us take the journey into truth. Vedanta is such a system. So are Sufism, Kabbalah, Taoism, Theravada, and Mahayana Buddhism and the disciplines of such highly evolved cultures as the Kogis and the Aborigines. So is a system that could be developed in the Christian tradition from the meditation techniques of the desert fathers and the writings of among others, Eckhart, Teresa of Avila, Hildegard of Bingen, and St. John of the Cross. These technologies have in common the knowledge that the divine self is the one essential fact of the cosmos, and ways to reveal and realize it are known and have been charted. Maps of the most helpful accuracy exist and can be interpreted with the help of those who have taken the journey. Astonishing similarities in the laws that each of these great systems honor, laws of meditation and contemplation, faith and devotion, charity, resignation, surrender, and adoration, prove their legitimacy. These are the laws of the only science that can reveal to us the essence of what we are and the essence of reality. If these laws are not now widely known and respected and acted on, it seems obvious now that the human adventure will soon end. And that's the end of part one. And I'll go on to part two. We still have about 20 minutes to the show. I hope you're enjoying this. This is an insightful work. And the book is about almost 300 pages, but it's a remarkable explanation. I should read something about the authors. I meant to do that earlier, but. Andrew Harvey was the youngest fellow ever elected to Oxford University. Born in India in 1952, he was educated in England and graduated from All Souls College in 1971. At age 25, he began his mystical journey and first meeting with the youthful avatar Mother Meera. Later, Turkshi Rinpoche, whose initiation of the author into Tibetan Buddhism led to Harvey's classic, A Journey in Ladakh. The author underwent extraordinary mystical experiences with the Divine Feminine, as recorded in The Hidden Journey. His latest book is A Way of Passion, A Celebration of Rumi. Mark Matusik was born in Los Angeles in 1957. He received his M.A. in English from the University of California in 1980. He began his publishing career as a theater critic for Reuters International, held an editorship in Newsweek magazine, and was senior editor at Interview of 3 years under the late artist publisher Andy Warhol. My God. In 1986, Matusik resigned from Interview to accompany Andrew Harvey to Germany, where he met Mother Meera. Back in the U.S., he began a new career as a freelance journalist, as contributing editor first to Common Boundary and then to Detail magazine. He is currently working on his memoirs to be published in spring 1996 by Putnam and Sons. So, definitely interesting fellows. Now, this book, it was a quest book, and it was published by the Theosophical Society in America. Yeah, you can check that out. Fascinating, though. I find it to be a fascinating book, much of what he said. I always question, unfortunately, people that are so worldly already been established in the literary field and in the field of global and have had global acceptance, right? So I read these because I read these books to you, and these things because they've grabbed me, and it doesn't mean that the messenger. I always wonder about the messengers, you know, of these things, but and where they're coming from, and you know they've been so immersed in classical thinking, and that they can't really think out of the box, you know. And that's something that's always. That's why I'm such an eclectic reader, because I can't. The few people that I find, the few authors I find. There are many authors that inspire me, mystics and poets and historians and so on, that seem to, sometimes they hit on the truth, you know, and you can tell what the truth is by the way it affects you in the heart and in the head, but at the same time, you have to wonder where these people come from, how they succeed so early in life, how they get on the proper path, how they are so trained, okay, by the proper people to become the proper voice or to become a proper, mouthpiece, if you will. And it bothers me some. It's like a priest, you know, or there's studies in the Catholic tradition, and, you know, could still be a pedophile, or, you know, it could be a wingnut, you know, so, and there are a lot of those out there, or preachers, or whatnot, so, in order to grab on to the truth, whatever the truth may be, you have to do a whole lot of searching, but more so, you have to do a lot of self-searching, you have to, you know, do you believe yourself, you know, do you believe what's coming at you, and there's something here that he reveals that in that first segment of yes, we are bombarded as a society, as a world, by a controlled media, by a controlled religions, by a controlled everything. I mean, we are just stifled to death, okay, by institutional thinking, and in many ways, these two gentlemen here, Andrew Harvey and Mark Matusik. I mean, the ultimate traditional thinkers, right? Even though in a spiritual awakening, perhaps, but nevertheless, you have to wonder. You have to always wonder if their journey is real or not. And when one calls himself a master, you know, I'm always reluctant to accept their. For instance, I like what Emerson has said, and he said he never wanted followers, you know. Never wanted anybody to believe, to follow him. He only wanted people to think for themselves. He never wanted to be called a master at anything, but merely a thinker and merely a guy who puts out the word and puts out some truth, possibly. And much you want to think about it and opens up a new world to you of thought and possibility. And that's the way I look at everything that I read. I'm not trying to, I mean, you can tell, I mean, if you go back to my many Thursday night programs at all the different things that I've read and all the different authors and the different subjects and the different areas from the Agni Yogi series to Emerson to conspiracy theorists, I mean everything, and maybe that's an example of a twisted mind like mine, but nevertheless, it's just sharing with you the my many travels, if you will. I never insist that anything I'm reading or telling you is truth. I'm leaving that up to you. But I feel the obligation to say, hey, here's something that I think you might want to hear. You know, and now there it is. So I've got about 10 minutes left, and I'm going to continue this. Didn't lose my place. Yeah, here it is. The Mystic Dilemma. The real problem behind these many controversies was the fact that no language existed in which one could speak consistently about the new situation. The ordinary language is based upon the old concepts of space and time. And that was quoted by Werner Heisenberg. And what I like about that is that they're talking about the ordinary language is based upon the old concepts of space and time. And if anybody has listened to our Friday night programs, we've delved into the Mayan concepts of space and time ending in 2012, as we know it. It'll take on a whole new dimension of thought, and hopefully we will evolve into a much higher and enlightened being as a human being. And another quote is, suppose a man has seen the ocean and somebody asks him, well, what is the ocean like? The first man opens his mouth as wide as he can and says, what a sight. What tremendous waves and sounds. And that was by Ramakrishna. And this is where words fail. For it is not of the past, present, or future. And that was by Third Zen Patriarch. Mark Matusik unfortunately mystics throughout history have frequently been accused of excess, exaggeration, hallucination, even outright fakery. In times like these that favor minimalism and cold, hard facts, this breach between the mystic mind and the prevailing rationalism has grown almost unbridgeable. Andrew Harvey states, it's crucial to address at the outset of these talks the problem of mystical language. What might be called its excessive, extravagant, theatrical side. The Upanishads talk of the ultimate samadhi being the bursting of a thousand suns. And Rumi talks about a hundred suns in the heart of the beloved that make all the hearts of the world burn. The Sufi master Shabistari says, know that the world is a mirror. In each atom nests 100 flaming suns, and from the split heart of one soul drop of water emerge 100 pure oceans. And it is easy to dismiss this kind of language as exaggeration, hysterical folly. It's easy to see the almost insane enthusiasm that the real mystic can manifest in moments as a form of psychosis. It's not surprising that throughout history mystics have been tortured and burnt, humiliated, derided, because what they reveal to the ego is the dreariness of its joys, the desolation of its empire, the vast dullness of its understanding, and the ego's revenge for being told the shattering good news that would end its dominion is to make the mystic look absurd. Well, Simon Weil says about the Song of Songs, it is hardly surprising that the mystics who wrote this should use the language of passion. Other kinds of lovers only borrow the language of passion, but it is the mystics by right. And what we hear in Joaquin's Desprez's music and in sketches of Beethoven's Missa Solemnis and in the poetry of Rumi and Kabar and Vyasa, Rabia, and Mirabai is a passion that makes all forms of worldly passion look absurdly tame, as an intensity that makes all forms of worldly intensity look barren, and a wildness that makes all forms of worldly wildness look crippled. There is no exaggeration in the language of the Upanishads and other mystic technologies. Actually, they underplay the experience, and language cannot express the extremity of the explosion of gnosis. It is never to be able to language. It will never be able to. Language ends where gnosis begins. What can language do? It can throw out its arms and dance. It can fling all of its jewels at the beloved's feet. It can create Taj Mahals in words, ransacking the world of the imagination for all its most priceless things, just as Shah Jahan ransacked the world for chrysolephantine and emeralds and rubies and seeds and seed pearls and Burmese teak. Just as Shah Jahan knew that creating that most amazing of buildings would be always only a pale shadow of the beauty of his wife and of the imageless splendor of his adoration of her, so the mystic knows that everywhere, that whatever he or she creates out of this great love will fall a million miles short of it, and their courage is to go on speaking of the unspeakable. And Mark Matusik says, or else, and Andrew Harvey states, to remain completely silent, as many masters have done. Otherwise, there is no alternative but to use all the resources of language and art of every kind to begin to express something of the splendor of truth, so that people trapped in illusion can begin to capture some part of the glory that is our true inheritance. It could not be a more difficult and discouraging time in which to do work like this. This time, as Kierkegaard and Nietzsche pointed out, institutionalizes the discouragement of passion, makes every effort to anesthetize it and deride it. And Kierkegaard said that living in industrial culture was like being trampled to death by geese. If he could say that in the 1830s, what would he say about what it is like to be alive today? In the Mathnawi, Rumi asks us to imagine what it would be like to tell an embryo in the womb about the world outside, the grasses, the birds, the marriage feast, the dances, the spiritual love. What would the embryo say? It would say, the world you are describing does not exist. All that exists is this dark place I am in. At any other time, mystics could find excuses to keep silent. We could vanish our life. We could vanish or live our private lives. Most mystic technologies, the Sufi, the Tibetan, and the Hindu and Christian, kept many of the secrets away from people. They knew that the secrets could only be understood by actual experience. But we now live in a time far too dangerous for that kind of silence. If the news of the true identity of human beings does not get out in the most striking way possible, the very future of the world is in jeopardy. We cannot afford that withdrawal, yet to talk nakedly as a mystic today is to risk everything. Wow. These problems of mystic testimony are little known in the West. This is from Mark Matusik. These problems of mystic testimony are little known in the West. Mystics have the tremendous difficulty of trying to communicate the truth of truths to a world which doesn't believe that truth is possible, and which most people in the media are metropolitan skeptics of a very tough kind. And Andrew Harvey says, I would like to send them all this quotation from Simon Weil on a postcard. Men or women of the most brilliant intelligence can be born. live and die in error and falsehood. In them, intelligence is neither good nor even an asset. The difference between more or less intelligent men is like the difference between criminals condemned to life imprisonment in smaller and larger cells. The intelligent person who is proud of his or her intelligence is like a condemned person proud of his or her cell. This reminds me of a story of love that the Tibetan master Patrul Rinpoche used to tell. There was a frog that lived in a dank, dark well. You might call that well New York or Paris or London or any of the urban prisons of the mind in which most of us live. And the frog thought that the whole world was this dank well. And one day another frog came to visit him from the sea. The two of them sat disconsolately on one of the mossy stones in the dank well. The well frog asked, "Where do you come from?" And he says, "I come from the sea." "What is the sea like? How big is it?" "The sea is enormous."